things we're concerned about, will he violently attack somebody else and kill them or me? So there are a few cases, arsons are the only ones I can think of, where we're particularly concerned about whether he would destroy property. We might be concerned about some people who have a history of armed robbery or robbery with violence. But mainly it is, will this man, when he gets away from the hospital, break down again, develop more mental illness, because the hospital is a very protective sort of environment, and people can often be quite well there, and when they're faced with the stresses of society again, then they begin to get a little more confused, a little more anxious, and their thinking begins to become twisted again, and they become a menace. These are the people that we have to test. And the only way we can test them often is by gradually extending their freedom, giving them privileges in the hospital and giving them a little bit of privilege to go out into the community and back, and we check them over months. But that's what we're concerned about mainly, is will they kill or injure people?
Well, Doctor, is it safe to say then that most of the people you're called upon to examine are those who are either have some history of violence or are charged with a crime of violence rather than some other less serious type of crime?
Violence or sex offenders. Arson would be, I suppose, maybe one of the 20 or one of the 10. Those are the three things. And the great majority are either sex offenders or crimes of violence.
This, and I think, is a good point. Dr. Levin has made a point with respect to repeated examinations of these people who are being held in mental institutions. And this, I think, is a good place to look at our job again, which is formulation of some kind of statutes to effectively deal with an insanity defense initially and the treatment and the control of these people later on. Now, one of the big problems, I think, bigger than the actual selection of a particular rule, not whatever it is, big problem is, what do you do with these people that have been committed? And we'll assume now, Doctor, that, and Jake, that these people are going to be held for a good number of years. If it's an extremely famous case of violence, a lot of three or four mass murders, something sort of thing, where he's going to be kept for a while because the doctors themselves, and we know that psychiatry is not an exact art any more than law is, and you can't tell at any given time with any certainty what that person will do if you decide to release him. So in short, a man is kept for a number of years, and there may be other cases of lesser serious crime where the person is kept in these mental institutions for a long time. How do we provide, or should we provide, a system that would force the state to periodically review the commitment of these people? Now, there have been suggestions, Professor Goldstein, in his book, The Insanity Defense, is not, in a general way, suggests that where we have a commitment following insanity, a finding of insanity, or perhaps even a competency to stand trial, or a civil commitment for, because it grew out of a criminal act, that there ought to be a provision for a minimum retention of that person, much like a sentence in a crime, 2 or 3 years, that he must be held there. Whether that's logical or not, there's an argument involved. But at the end of that 2 or 3 years, then the state must grant that person yearly, the Professor Goldstein suggests that's not necessarily needed, but a periodic review of his case, and in that review, the state would have the burden of showing that that person should still remain in custody of the mental institution.
In judicial review.
Beg your pardon?
Judicial review, not a...
Yes, a judicial court review, based, of course, on the facts and findings, essentially the evidence would be from the institution, and the defense, the defendant, or the person in the keeping would, I presume, have his own attorney and so forth, be able to make it an adversary process. Now, this would, if it's deemed advisable, or if it should happen to be practical, would have the effect of solving perhaps part of the problem. That is, it would incline more people to adopt the insanity defense because they wouldn't fear, whether or not the practice in Oregon is this way, they wouldn't fear a very long indeterminate detention, one that they might escape by simply getting a 1 to 2 year sentence under a minor burglary charge or something of this sort.
I don't believe, however, that I disagree with you, Professor, when you say, suggest that defense attorneys, who after all are the ones that make the decisions, it isn't the client in 90% of the cases or more. I don't think defense attorneys in Oregon, in fact, avoid asserting insanity because they fear a long period of detention if they get lucky and succeed. I'm reasonably satisfied, although I've never sat down and talked to the first five active defense lawyers that came along, but I'm reasonably satisfied that the fear of a long, unreviewed detention in the hospital is a very, very seldom a meaningful consideration in the decision that the defense attorney makes. I'd say if you took, let's say, Oscar Howlett, Howard Lonergan, Tom Kerrigan, and two others, just to name two or three who have a substantial amount of business in the criminal defense field, and asked them, I bet you that very, very seldom would that, in fact, contribute much to that decision. I really don't think it does.
Yeah, because if there's really any danger of any long-term commitment in the hospital, the person is usually so obviously insane that there's going to be no... It's really a stipulated situation of the not guilty by reason of insanity rather than anything else. The only time that I can think of where maybe you might get into this type of thing that I noticed in your article here, and also Goldstein in his book, has quite a bit of concern about the length of commitment as being a deterrent to the insanity defense. The only time that I can think they'd come up would be where a person has committed some crime so minor that he's going to, like he's dealing with a misdemeanor, where he's going to, the most he'd probably get on a guilty verdict is going to be 30 to 60 days, or if even that long, then the commitment to the state hospital might be some deterrent to raising the insanity defense, but usually the person's in the situation where they need the, where they really need the insanity defense, even if it is a minor crime like that, then a civil commitment procedure is usually brought and sent to the hospital without even going through the criminal procedure.
Professor.
Again, I'm talking out here for the time about the other guy's experience, but it seems to me that judges, defense lawyers, prosecutors, laymen, and people generally, maybe even in the last 10 years, have become a great deal more at ease with the whole concept of mental illness and a lot less threatened by treatment in the hospital, for instance, that they don't. There has been, in 20 years, 25 years, there's been a great deal of change in how the hospital operates since the use of drugs in the hospital and this kind of thing. And it's been a pretty good selling job that was very necessary to do, that mental illness is not as frightening and that something can be done, and that the way it's treated is humane and thoughtful and kind and this kind of thing. So I think there's less concern about it.
I think that's the essential point. There's always a communication lag between one field and another, and the stereotype about mental hospitals is about 15 to 20 years out of date, and there's been a tremendous revolution in hospitals throughout the Western world in the last, even the last 10 years, but especially in the last 20. And the concern of somebody getting tossed in a mental hospital there and left there indefinitely just doesn't apply, at least in most of the Western states. If you have an adequate mental hospital and adequately staffed, it just doesn't happen. And what happens if somebody is committed to us, well, our purpose is to get them out as soon as possible. And they're reviewed constantly.
the cases that really get in this bind are the people that are sent to us who are unable to stand trial, and where there's a tremendous amount of local feeling about the act that the person committed. And we have gotten into hassles with the courts and district attorneys about whether or not this man's ready to stand trial. We think he is, and we send him back, and they don't want it. They want him out of circulation, and they won't try. Now, we have gone so far as to advise this man that he should sue us, give his corpus, and get him out that way.
This is what I was going to ask. Are there any substantial numbers that you deem not ready to stand trial, but yet not dangerous to society as such? Is there any? Is this a problem at all?
It is a problem. And one of the things I think that should be looked at, and it's even worse with the mentally retarded, I don't deal with them now, but when I was with the mental health division, it was a constant problem, because by definition, a mentally retarded person, if he's not able to stand trial, probably isn't ever going to be able to stand trial. Mm-hmm. So it seems to me this not standing trial should have a time limit on it, so that the thing has to be disposed of. And we have had people committed to the institution for the retarded, and it's never established whether they committed the act or they didn't commit the act.
I think I saw one the other day, Jake, 26 years in the District of Columbia, held before they deemed him ready to stand trial. No indication of whether he would have been dangerous to anybody if he'd been released in the meantime.
I think there's a problem in this area. That's where it is, not in the person who has been found not guilty and committed.
Yeah, I'm trying to state my information is based on the literature and not on practical experience here in Oregon with respect to the commitment following an insanity, a successful insanity defense. But I think what I said was certainly meant to apply to this very difficult competency to stand trial issue. Now, evidently, we do have some problems. At least Dr. Levin feels that we might have some problems here that we don't have with respect to a commitment following a not guilty by reason of insanity plea. Which means, do we, as a commission, try to cope with this, to establish some kind of periodic examinations? Would they really be useful to reiterate what might be, and I'm not saying here, I'm just guessing, and the doctor I think would agree, what might be a problem in Oregon. I'd like to change the subject a little bit, but still stay on the same subject by mentioning a case that has troubled me since I read it. It's a recent case in the Supreme Court, State versus Van Cleek. Were any of you involved in that by any chance, other than, of course, Justice Sloan as a member of the court? This is the woman who killed her three small children by cutting their throats and drowning them. The result was that some four psychiatrists testified that she was insane under McNaughton. Two for the state testified she wasn't insane on the control the test questions, but all of them agreed that she was mentally ill, that she had impulsive ideas. I think the term here used by the court is impulsive, obsessive compulsive neurosis. At any rate, she was mentally ill. Obviously, a mother who kills her three small children, there's something wrong with her. I think as a layman, we could always agree with that. The result of the case was she was prosecuted for murder in the first degree and found guilty of second degree murder and sentenced to 25 years in the penitentiary. And the Supreme Court approved that in language which says the trial court apparently believed that for the protection of society, it was required to sentence this troubled woman to the maximum of 25 years in the penitentiary. We cannot conclude that the trial court was clearly in error in assessing this sentence. 25 years means that in seven she'd be entitled to parole. The court mentions that in its opinion. Now, the reason I'm raising this issue is, now here we have a case short of insanity under McNaughton. We have really a reduced or partial responsibility case. And in effect, that's what she was convicted for, not premeditated murder, but second degree murder, although the issue of partial responsibility isn't raised in the case. But in effect, we have someone mentally ill who was convicted of second degree murder, who couldn't prove she was insane. Now, if in fact, doctor, she was found to be insane under McNaughton, would a person in general, not this specific case, because obviously you can't speculate on her sickness or her illness, would she be better off in a mental institution with an indeterminate sentence, as it were, an indeterminate commitment, or is she better off sentenced to 25 years in the penitentiary, where she's presumably not going to get any mental help at all, medical help?
I would think if she has a treatable mental illness, and I happen to know this case because she's currently being reviewed by us at the hospital, so I can't just deal with it and somebody I don't know. If a person has a treatable mental illness, as this woman did have, I think she and society are much better off to have her in the state hospital on a regular court commitment, because there we can keep her until she's reasonably well. We don't feel
it might be far less than 7 years, or it might be far longer than 25.
We've run into this problem with two or three other women that we've encountered that have killed their children, and they're most unlikely to commit this crime again if they don't look after their children. So the need for incarceration is usually quite brief. The need for some continuous outpatient treatment might be quite prolonged.
Is there not an administrative transfer arrangement of some sort between the penitentiary and the hospital?
Yes, there is. They can
the corrections division can do it. Yes. Can they not? I'm sure they can.
Well, it raises this whole problem of partial responsibility that I'd like to have us focus our attention on. I don't know if we can solve it or not. But the Model Penal Code, in a section in Article 4, provides for partial responsibility. It's section 403, I'm not sure. Let me look here just a second. Section 4.02, subparagraph 1, which I did not include in our suggested draft because I think it's an issue that you might not at this point want to grapple with, but I think you're going to have to grapple with it. And in fact, subparagraph 1 of section 402 says, evidence that the defendant suffered from a mental disease or defect is admissible whenever it is relevant to prove that the defendant did or did not have a state of mind, which is an element of the offense. All right, now let's look at the Van Fleet. This woman presumably will assume could make a very good defense that she did not have the mental capacity to premeditate, could not be convicted, therefore, of murder in the first degree. If Oregon has this defense, and there, it's completely undecided, as I read the cases, there is no holding whether Oregon will follow the partial responsibility doctrine.
In practice, it's followed.
Evidently, the Supreme Court at least has not been opposed to it. It just never had the question before directly.
Well, in a sense, it has, really. Like
in the felony murder case?
I'm thinking one case in particular where the court reduced a first-degree murder conviction to second degree because of intoxication. Mm-hmm. Now, this really went to the elements of premeditation. What it amounted to was partial responsibility.
Right. Did that state where we have that?
I can't remember the name of it. I never remember these cases.
Of course, Justice Sloan realizes that we have that provision by statute. Intoxication may be considered by the jury with respect to
that. But I don't think this was necessarily involved with the statute.
Yes.
Of course, that would be involved.
I frankly think it's coming in Oregon. It's coming and it's expanding throughout the country. In 1925, I saw, reading an article, there were just two states that followed the partial responsibility doctrine, and now there are 12.
How does it
And I think there will be more.
How does that come up? Does it come up in terms of admission of evidence or instruction to jury or?
Well, Oregon has clearly said, the Supreme Court has said, that if you're going to plead insanity, you must give notice. And that includes evidence of mental incompetency to form premeditation. We know that is the rule. Now, we don't know what the rule is on partial responsibility, but there is a case that says that if the defendant is going to put any evidence in on mental defect or disease, doesn't have to be insanity under McNaught. If he's going to put any kind of mental illness evidence in, he's got to give it a special plea so that the state will be alarmed or told about this situation. And now coming back to Dr. Trelevin, if in fact we get a partial responsibility or partial responsibility doctrine in Oregon, if we adopt, in short, the Model Penal Code, or if our Supreme Court clearly states that we do have this doctrine, and the mother is convicted of second-degree murder because she has been successful in reducing the crime of first degree because of her mental illness to second degree, so she has been successful under the partial responsibility doctrine and is sentenced now, not committed, because it's still not insanity, you understand? It's still short of insanity.
She's sentenced to 25 years. Would it not, or is it, advisable for us as a commission to suggest to the legislature that it provide for a discretionary authority in the court at that point to commit this woman to a mental institution, much as the procedure now exists for committing where the defense or the verdict has been not guilty by reason of insanity? Would this not be a better way to handle this kind of case? Because, certainly, mental illness, very close to legal insanity, is involved. If the woman is sentenced, or if the person who is sentenced under the reduced responsibility, the partial responsibility, to a sentence, let's say, that's 1 to 5, and serves 3 years, and in fact then is entitled to get out, or serves them whatever it takes to get out, and be entitled to be discharged from prison, that person may still be very dangerous to society, and has not been treated unless there's been an administrative shifting, and that probably would be sort of an ad hoc arrangement. So that we're discharging a dangerous person in the sense of violence into society without giving the doctors the chance to try to help this person. Should we cope with that kind of a problem at all?
I think we should. Mr. Clark, you
This goes back, by the way, to one of the doctor's statements about the retarded. And this gets back to this book, Psychiatric Justice, and the thesis of this is that we have these people who are not that time competent to be tried under the facts of the case because they are retarded. And they always will be retarded. We never have decided whether this person did or did not commit the act, which may indeed have an effect on whether the person is allowed back in the community again. And some way or other, I don't understand how you do this, but if you could determine if the person is as adequate as he ever is going to be to help in his own defense, at that point, if he did do this act, he might well be judged not to have done this act, and he may, at that time, because of that fact, be let out from his institution on the streets. Or he could be incarcerated for years and years in the institution on the basis that they think he might have committed the act. Now, that's the thing that concerns me. Now, how do you handle that?
Well, I just clearly then raised the issue of the bifurcated or split trial, which is a problem I think that we ought to discuss here in this subcommittee.
You know, George, I think you're bouncing back to the idea that was suggested by Mr. Rubin from National Council of Crime and Delinquency that spoke to the full commission during at least the first session I was aware of. And what he said made an awful lot of good sense, except that I thought I'd raise great difficulty in talking about intent, generally, the definition of crime. When he was asked whether or not, or which of the definitions of criminal insanity, criminal responsibility we ought to adopt, he said that we should stick with McNaughton, or even better, do away with it entirely, and let the trial concern itself only with whether the defendant committed the act charged, and then allow psychiatric evaluation in psychiatric terms, free from any of the three primary artificial concepts that the lawyers have worked up, and then allow to the judge sentencing options of hospital, probation, correctional institution, penitentiary, whatever else is available. Personally, I thought that made tremendously good sense because, I mean, I think we all agree that ALI doesn't mean a damn thing, McNaughton doesn't mean anything, Durham doesn't mean anything.
In fact, the business is that it's
in the psychiatric terms.
All it is a shouting match between psychiatrists and the one that sells the jury best going to get its verdict.
And certainly,
depending on how mad the jury is at the particular defendant because of the type of crime he committed to.
What we're really talking about is the appropriate disposition of the case.
Precisely. Mr. Chairman, let me second that, because from the psychiatrist's point of view, it doesn't make a bit of sense to me to worry about whether the man was guilty or not. First thing you want to know is, did he do it? And then the second thing you want to know is, what needs to be done with him to correct and treat and rehabilitate him, and what needs to be done to protect society from him? And really, when it comes right down to practical matters, that's what you're trying to do anyway.
You're going to have the evaluation before, though, before the trial Mr. Rubin was talking about, as to whether he's able to assist in his defense, of course.
Yeah.
I think that's a separate issue that perhaps we ought to.
I think that's really what I'm looking for too, is what they're talking about now.
This is what I feel. I mean, maybe a person is only wouldn't qualify under McNaughton, wouldn't qualify under the ALI, and there might be a question as to whether he'd even qualify under Durham. But it's, if you're going to rehabilitate him rather than sending him to the penitentiary, if the court had the authority just simply as in the disposition procedure to commit him for a period of time, I mean, it has to be somewhat indeterminate, but not longer than his maximum authority to send, I suppose, to the state hospital until he is well, is able to come back out into society, then have him come back out. And it probably would be better for the person than a period of incarceration. And you wouldn't really have to worry about what the test of insanity was. It's simply what's going to be best for that particular defendant. But I know in this Goldstein thing, I was trying to find it here, that he talked about this and he was against it, and apparently there have been some Supreme Court cases in some states that said that say that this is unconstitutional, violating due process and taking away his right to a jury trial, and because the question of mens rea is one of the elements of any type of a crime, and so that that he has a right to have determined by a jury, and so it's unconstitutional to have this type of thing. I mean,
I agree. I'm not at all sure how you can do it without just totally disrupting the idea of criminal intent, you know, when you're defining other statutes. But at the very least, you know, if we couldn't perhaps take a revolutionary step like that, perhaps the commission should think more in terms of drafting a narrow rule and broadening the alternatives available to the sentencing judge.
No, I would certainly agree. This was the thing that was going through my mind, and the more I listened, was that really what we're talking about is what's done with the person. And it would seem to me like that, I don't know whether politically or advisedly, the commission could consider such an approach as this, to this answer of criminal responsibility by reason of insanity, or mental illness of any kind, and so forth. But to approach it from that point of view, rather than from whether or not this is defense, and I was just thinking of these, particularly these cases that attain such notoriety, and even those that don't, but usually this kind of case is one that involves, as George said at the outset, a lot of publicity. But what will happen when this Suran comes to trial, and all these others, that if the advantages to the state, to the people, and to the court system, if in the initially all you had to determine was whether or not this man in fact committed the act, what a tremendous burden this would lift from the courts, a 2 or 3 or 4 weeks trial, and then come back in and make a determination of what should be done with it. I'm rather startled to learn that some of the courts have held this unconstitutional.
Well, it does away with mens rea.
Well, what is constitutional about that?
May I respond to a couple of
I've never heard something constitutional about everything these days.
You know, one of the things that is shocking to me here, really, from the point of view of the kind of work we do, and this is one of the things that bothers me constantly, is that when the court is concerned with the rules of this kind, that how frequently we sit down and we rely on writings like Professor Goldstein or other people who have studied it from the point of view of written records and so forth. And when you get to the actual things that is really happening, And we learned here, for instance, from Jake and Dr. Gilleman and so forth, they present an entirely different picture. That a study of this kind, such as this committee can do, or a legislative committee can do, and so forth, where you can learn all points of view. I have a hunch that if the Supreme Court of the United States could have done something like this, they might never have written the Miranda decision.
They wouldn't have written the Wade decision if they'd ever been in the lineup.
Right. That's all beside the point.
Here's. Do you want me to?
Go ahead.
A more sustained effort might, of course, be made to eliminate all questions of mental condition from the first stage, but the California courts have intimated that it would be unconstitutional to do so. Here they're talking about because of partial responsibility, where you got the kid crying, and they have case law on their side. The only two attempts in our history to eliminate both the mens rea requirement and the insanity defense have been unsuccessful. Statutes were held by the courts of Washington and Mississippi to deny due process of law, depriving defendants of a jury trial on defenses which had always been passed on by the jury. This right of trial, said the Washington courts, must mean something more than a preservation of the mere form of trial by jury, else the legislature could by the process of defining crime or criminal procedure, entirely destroy the substance of the right of limiting the questions to be submitted to the jury. Issue of insanity, the court contained, was too intrinsic to the concept of crime to permit its removal by legislation. It is patent to all men that the status and condition in the eyes of the world and under the law of one convicted of crime is vastly different from one simply judged insane. To convict an insane man, said the Mississippi court, in tones remarkably like those of Robinson versus California, would be cruel and unusual punishment.
That issue was raised in the Van Cleek case, too. It was argued that a 25-year sentence when this woman was really ill was a cruel and unusual punishment, and our Supreme Court dispensed in one sentence. It just simply wasn't attractive to them. I'm not being critical in the stand of the court, Justice Sloan. I'm pointing out facts.
What page do you read?
This is on page 222. This is the insanity defense, and I'm trying to look over to that. There are some notes here that I assume give the citations of these Washington Mississippi cases.
While he's looking, have any of the rest of you read Goldstein's book, and so you have any comments?
It's an excellent book. I recommend it. It's been reviewed by enough people to give me a perspective that it is a good book, that it's not a superficial job. And I recommend it highly. It's in paperback, $1.95, I think.
I would very much like to see this commission get the work called Psychiatric Justice. I don't know. I can't remember who wrote it. I'm going to try and find the publisher and the author and so on. But I think it speaks to all of this we're talking about now, and I think it's a very valuable kind of thing to be concerned about. I would like to find some way to do just what we've been talking about. Now, there may be all kinds of problems that are much too technical for me to understand. But this is a practical kind of thing. I see a great deal of virtue in that kind of system.
I'd like to call the Commission's attention, and perhaps some of you have read this excellent article written in 1962 by Professor Lucell and Jeffrey Hazard, who used to be here in Oregon with the one of the judicial administration
committees
in 1959 or so. Anyhow, he's not unknown here. But they did not a professorial ivory tower study, as Courtney and I are often given to do, but they were commissioned by a state legislative committee to go into the field and find out how the bifurcated or split trial system was working in California, and make recommendations. I'll read you their recommendations first so you know where they came out. Very briefly, they said, "The separate trial procedure was based on an inaccurate premise of law. It assumed that the issue of guilt and the issue of mental condition are separable. We submit that reason shows they are not separable and that experience confirms this conclusion. We therefore believe that the separate trial procedure should be abolished." Now, California, I don't think, has abolished the system yet, but there's great dissatisfaction with the split trial system, principally because of the mens rea requirement of all major crimes in our jurisprudence. You simply cannot try guilt in the first trial without, in many cases, talking about the mental element of, which is involved in premeditation. I'm inclined to say, gee, this looks like a good system and a real solution, but I think that the results of the California study show that there was just as much testimony on insanity in the first trial as there was in the second, and it really just complicated and extended the procedures, that they would have been better dealt with in the traditional one-trial concept. That's what this particular study seems
to be. That's because when we talk about, although we talk about insanity as a defense to crime, I would suspect that probably 98 or 99% of the insanity defenses raised are, you're talking about homicide cases. So that when you do allow, as California does, this partial responsibility, you've got a first degree murder trial, you've got that the psychiatric testimony and testimony of his mental condition, dealing if not with his total insanity, but certainly with the question of whether or not he's can premeditate, deliberate, this type of thing. And it seems to me that maybe when you talk about that you've got to have that your sanity question has got to come into whether or not a person committed a crime, that you get into simply just a question of determination of fact. Did he commit the act? Whether
but
it's
you're
a crime
guilty,
or not.
Aren't you?
Well,
if I shoot someone and I'm found guilty of the act, what a terrible stigma, when in fact I had a complete self-defense argument. And the only way I can raise it is because of my mental attitude and my mental life.
Well,
see the point I make?
Well,
no. That wouldn't be true, because diminished responsibility would enter into the first trial.
Yeah.
That's part of the definition of.
Yes, but the California practice has shown that really is the issue that's going to be raised in the second trial. That the evidence is in on insanity in the very trial in which you don't want it in.
But what I'm saying is that if at the second trial the person is found to be insane, he's not guilty of the crime that he was. Actually, that first trial is just a finding of fact as to whether or not did he commit this act, and did he do it with premeditation and deliberation. Now, if they take out the partial responsibility and limit that to the second trial, then your first trial could be a trial just on the facts. Now, whether that can could be done. I mean, did the person plan his killing? Did he deliberate? Now, Graham, maybe he's insane or his mental condition is involved in this.
Yes, and wouldn't the defense counsel, and in what you're saying, be entitled to introduce all evidence to show he was insane? Where does this get us, is the point I'm raising.
Just so I can close this book up, anybody that...
I'm sorry, I really should.
You
I'm
take
so
it
interested in something that I'm getting into the dialogue.
Reset. These cases, the Washington case that he's quoting from is State versus Strasburg, 110 Pacific, page 1020, decided in 1910. The Mississippi case is Sinclair versus State, 132 Southern, 581, and this was decided in 1931.
Let me add to that another citation. An Oregon Law Review article written in 1930 by Judge Brandt, who at that time was a circuit judge and was reporting to the Judicial Conference and later was on our Oregon Supreme Court, in which he discusses in detail what the Oregon reaction would be under Oregon law to doing away with the jury in insanity cases, citing by analogy to Oregon cases. I think that article is in 9 Oregon Law Review, 309. The whole article doesn't deal with that subject, but there is a discussion in there of that point. And he concludes that the jury trial may not be abolished in Oregon in the case of insanity.
has been. We've got 37 years of public
service. Well, the Supreme Court has spoken on jury trials recently.
This is an alternative. Well, maybe the jury just might say, I was going to suggest perhaps some sort of special verdict form instead of bifurcated trial. Still have one trial, yet tell the jury to answer certain questions, specific questions, and perhaps tie sentencing options to their answers. And it's not a thought out idea, it's just an alternative.
I saw a reaction in court to that.
Well, it's a kind of a too much of a conclusion reaction. It's nothing like this. I think that the bifurcated trial idea is often complicated. I suppose I'm more conservative than I ought to be. And my conservative thinking isn't very conservative, but it works along these lines. But I think we ought to do things, the general procedure, something like it is not. I would urge that we adopt a non-chemical formulation, not in the wording particularly, but that since we do allow broad psychiatric testimony, we ought to legitimize whatever the word is. So that some judge in Iron County or someplace doesn't all of a sudden up and say, no, you can't have this testimony, but you're having Oklahoma County, Marion County, and Lane County. I think that the basic frustration of the whole thing is that what Judge Burns raised early in the game, that really we know more to do with people than we have facilities to do with them. We've got big maximum security penal institutions, maybe if there were more psychiatrists dealing with treating people, then to testify whether they're guilty or insanity would be helpful. It's a question of the large segment of the population still being wanting retribution. And people involved in corrections feeling that their retribution isn't exactly the right thing. And the desire for more treatment, but how much treatment will society afford and apply.
Don, so
we're always in transition.
Don, do you have any comments on our general trend this morning on this problem in particular?
Well, no, I don't think we're at the point yet where we can make an evaluation.
I'd like to add some information here, strictly information, which some of you may be aware of, with respect to the split trial situation. I've already cited the California Law Review article to the effect that the people who studied it in California feel that it is not a workable system for reasons that we've talked about a little bit. There's also a very recent article in the Washington Law Review on the insanity defense, which discusses, incidentally, the bifurcated trial, and talks about the history of it, and I think this is the article source, but the author points out that several states, not by any means a majority, have in years long gone by shifted from their traditional uniform trial to a bifurcated or split trial system and have long since shifted back. That the indications we can conclude, if we can conclude at all from that kind of scanned information, that those states at least found it unworkable because they gave it up. Now, as I understand it, California, Texas, and Louisiana, I believe, have for a while had the split trial system in one form or another. And very interestingly, Wisconsin has just shifted within the last year to a split trial system as a result of a Supreme Court opinion. Supreme Court rule, I guess you'd call it.
How many of these are states where they still have the death penalty?
That I couldn't answer.
I'm wondering how much effect that has on this, the protest against what you could call a split trial.
This might be a good point, Chairman.
The thing I'm wondering about that I was thinking of more than from the point of view of the bifurcated trial would again depend in part on what the commission eventually does in the way of sentencing for all kinds of things. And that is, if the commission should eventually come to the conclusion that conceivably, instead of the court actually passing a sentence of so many years or so much confinement or some such thing, would sentence them as
to a limited extent in the federal system, where, as I understand it, the, at least it used to be, the sentence was to the custody of the Attorney General. And he then puts them in a mental institution or a narcotics institution or a close confinement institution or whatever the apparent needs of the person may be. That if we could adopt something like that where they are sentenced to a board whose function it is to evaluate the person, and he goes to the state hospital or he goes to the correctional institution or he goes to solitary confinement or he is put on probation or he's given some kind of limited custody of down the road, that this might not solve some of these constitutional questions, if they are constitutional questions, where you treat all of them this way.
We might reach that result, Justice Sloan, under a system of leaving uniform trial as it is now, and providing that where mental illness, whether it goes to the issue of insanity or partial responsibility, where that is in the trial, that the judge then has the discretion of treating the man or committing the man, anything of that sort, but of giving the state the authority to proceed after the jury has made its regular, standard, traditional verdict. And I agree with Courtney on that. I guess I join you in conservatism, and I kind of feel that departing to a split trial system might be the kind of radical change, especially in light of the troubles that it's caused in other states, that would not be the solution to our problem.
Incidentally, the Wisconsin shift was not based upon the insanity problem.
That's right.
As such, the Fifth Amendment problem, which I'd like to raise again when we get to Section 2.
Yeah, but I think that's going to be the ultimate issue on the bifurcated trial.
Well, I think
the idea, though, that Judge Sloan raises of empowering the Division of Corrections to also send a person, or perhaps the judge, to send a person to the hospital where appropriate, would rather take care of something like the Van Cleek case of a very troubled person who doesn't qualify under the definition of criminal insanity. Because I think we have to realize when we're choosing which definition of criminal insanity we're talking about here, that we're not trying to define psychiatric or medical insanity. We're talking about which person should be held responsible for what they do. And I mean, the word responsibility is quite accurate. It's not, insanity is the wrong word. And at least on a theoretical basis, not knowing that case, that woman was held to be, rather, whether sick or not, responsible. Now she may, because of her troubled condition, be entitled to more humane custody, or more productive custody in terms of treatment.
Chair, if I make a comment, it seems to me that no matter how you look at this, you always get in a dilemma in human behavior as to what is the potential responsibility of a person, or what is their ability to be responsible. And you can't really win in this, because if you say the person's not responsible, then you tend to maintain that condition of irresponsibility. This is what we found out in caring for mentally ill people. If we treat them as not responsible, then they don't act responsible. So that really doesn't quite work. Now, I'd like to make a plea from the point of view of the mental hospital system that whatever you decide, don't put us in the position of trying to fill the role of punishment for custody or to get even with you for what you did. I think that concept is applicable maybe for fairly normal people and minor crimes like a traffic violation. But it certainly doesn't apply to the vast majority of people that we see, either in the correctional system or in the mental hospital system. It just isn't an appropriate model. It doesn't deal with their problems or society's problems with them. But now, we don't want any part of that.
You say you don't want to abandon the idea of responsibility, though. But you don't want to have imposed the idea of some punishment. Those are not usually...
All he's saying is that for those who have a mental illness, they can take care of them. For those who've been caught up in the toilet of the law but aren't mentally ill and need presumably correction, but they're not in the correction business.
Let me maybe elaborate that on a little more. I think the correctional services and institutions are moving much more into the medical model or treatment model or whatever you wish to call it. And I think that most of them would not want to be in the punishment business either. And in view of what Courtney said, I feel that maybe there is a primitive impulse in all people to respond to aggression with aggression and want to get even if somebody does some dastardly act. But I think most people are reasonable enough that if they feel that their security is not threatened, if they know the problem of the disturbed individual or delinquent individual is going to be dealt with, then they can relax and say, all right, we'll take a pragmatic and practical approach. We'll abolish this punishment business. And if you can arrive at that conclusion, then I think you're in a much more practical position of dealing with the individuals that commit serious acts. I don't think you'd find very many people, if any, who commit rape, murder, and mayhem and all the rest of it that aren't really seriously disturbed individuals one way or the other.
You wouldn't go along then with the idea of a minimum commitment in the case of a defense of insanity, I take it, as somebody suggested earlier.
No, I'm really quite opposed to that, because I think we would like you to deliver the person to us with the charge that we're to treat and restore and rehabilitate if possible, and at the same time use all of our judgment and abilities to take the interests of society into consideration and us make the judgments.
So would you be doing the same thing in corrections with a indeterminate sentence with a maximum that goes off into infinity?
My personal opinion is, and I'm not an expert in corrections, but I think that for a large percentage of the people that get involved in the correctional system, this is the only way to handle the problems. It's most inappropriate to let somebody who's going to repeat a crime, a serious crime, loose on society when any behavioral scientist can study his case and tell you the chances are 9 out of 10 that it's going to happen.
This is, I talked last night with Dr. Calvin. I had hoped to have mentioned to Don that I had hoped to have three of the psychiatrists from Portland here, and unfortunately none could be here. Dr. Calvin, however, was kind enough to give me his thoughts last night, and I'll do my best to repeat them briefly after he had looked over the draft. I should say this also, Dr. Calvin is generally felt to be, I think, in these polarized terms, a prosecution psychiatrist as opposed to, let's say, Henry Dixon Jr., whom I think everyone characterized as a defense psychiatrist. Dr. Haugen was instrumental, or said he was, I won't say instrumental, he was active, he said, in 1961 in working on Governor Hatfield to veto the statute in 1961, which would have made this change. Dr. Haugen has spent 18 years as a psychiatrist.
I didn't hear what you said, the veto what bill?
When Hatfield vetoed the ALI bill in 1961, Dr. Haugen has spent 18 years as a psychiatric consultant to the State Board of Parole. He said, in his opinion, and he sees essentially the tough cases. He doesn't see the larceny and burglary thing. He sees the armed robber and this sort of thing. He said, in his opinion, if we made the change indicated, that of those he sees in his work for the parole board, these are persons in prison on hard, serious cases, that of those, he feels about 20% would probably have proper insanity defenses, that is, that they would not be able to conform their conduct and so on, in terms of this change. He says also that if the courts get to the point that they declare alcoholism a disease, this would increase a great amount those who would qualify under the ALI test. He says, frankly, he doesn't feel that the language that we adopt is nearly as important as it used to be with no death penalty. He says, in his experience, there's no rush about changing the present rule. He says that he can only recall in his years of experience three persons who were found not to be insane under McNaughton, who he really felt were insane. He also said, as a matter of prediction, he felt that probably psychiatrists in general, presumably speaking of those in private practice, would probably, in general, endorse this proposal, and he thought it would have a good effect in possibly taking the psychiatrists out of the adversary position in which they feel very uncomfortable.
Psychiatrists in general, in other words, to go along with.
That's what he said as a matter of prediction. He hadn't made this is just on his general background. Now, I think I have accurately stated the substance of what he told me.
Did he say that he would oppose the model penal code version again?
Yes, he is not in favor of it. He would stay with the McNaughton rule. But he said that he thinks probably the psychiatrists as a group here would go for this proposal. He also indicated that at the time that we get ready to circulate whatever drafts we wish to, that there are two groups, one called the Portland Psychiatrists in Private Practice, and the other is the Oregon District Branch of the American Psychiatric Association, that either of those groups would be ones to whom we probably would want to circulate the draft. For whatever benefit that may be, I have tried to be active in that report.
Thank you very much. Any questions or good?
I'm sure that if Hank Dixon were here, you would get a different response. And although I must say, all of the psychiatrists I have talked to, and I've talked to quite a few over the years about this problem, I'm sure that all of them honestly feel that they're terribly uncomfortable in the battle of war of words that they get into in court in an adversary proceeding. They do not like it. And they're as unhappy with it as everybody else is.
Dr. Hagen probably illustrates the problem of choosing a rule. I don't know that he's prosecution oriented. Thing which I think distinguishes him and Dr. Campbell from other psychiatrists who one might say are defense-oriented is that he doesn't feel free to attach his own meanings to the words. In other words, he when he's called upon to apply McNaughton, he does so in a very literal sense. Dr. Dixon, whom you mentioned, who is very much defense-oriented, and to a lesser degree many other doctors, they don't feel bound by the words. They simply give their opinions and somehow fasten into their own interpretation of the words which McNaughton said. They manage to get to fashion their conclusion into the rule. That's what I'm saying. And what the rule really does, I think, is set sort of an outward limit on testimony and on conclusions given, which isn't bad. Now, in the case, there's another recent case in D.C. which uses Durham. It's only about 6 months old, where they concluded that the psychiatrists, with all respect, doctor, were getting out of hand, and were substituting, just their own conclusions for thorough explanation and all that. I mean, Durham says, if the defect resulted in the crime, or if the crime is a result of the defect, that's it. And the psychiatrist would get up and testify as to that conclusion, and he would elucidate a little bit. And they passed a court rule barring such conclusory testimony from the psychiatrist. They said the important thing is, and I think wisely, the important thing is for the psychiatrist to be able to testify fully and then allow the jury to come to their conclusion. There's a First Circuit case, I believe it's the First Circuit, it's federal, and it's Eastern. About 2 years ago, it's in Law Week, and I can find it if need be, where McNaughton was challenged. And the court responded, and the defendant was trying to get them to adopt Kearns or AOI or Durham. The court responded that it really doesn't matter, you know, which rule is picked. The question is how extensive the psychiatric testimony is going to be. Not the conclusions, but whether they were able to explain to the jury what the makeup of the man was. And they said that whatever rule is used, the jury is going to come to a basically common sense answer, so long as they have the full information. I think that's largely true, and I think that we should look to the rule that the commission chooses in terms of simply, you know, what sort of limitation upon testimony it would make for, realizing also that the psychiatric witnesses, and of course the lawyers who use them, will attempt to push the limitations of the rule to its outer limits. Under McNaughton, which is a very narrow rule, the testimony is extremely broad in our courts. They're allowed to do just about everything except conclude that the defendant, because of mental disease or defect, lack of substantial capacity, either to appreciate that. They can do everything except say the words of the AOI formulation right now.
In Oregon,
I don't think that's bad.
In Oregon, the psychiatrist may answer the question, do you think the defendant was insane? They may say yes or no. But they may not say, as I understand it, that he was responsible or knew the difference between right and wrong. There is a limit.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to raise another point now. We're talking about expert testimony, which I think is the most, by far the most important testimony in an insanity hearing. What about lay testimony? Is this, the first question is it important at all? And the second question is, if it is important, how would this fall under a rule or a new statute which would prohibit a psychiatrist from coming to any conclusions? The lay witness comes to conclusions, really. He can't explain why he thinks this guy is crazy. He says he was acting crazy because he was talking this way or he walked that way. And he gives his opinion that the man is insane based on observations of a lay. Now, is this kind of evidence important? Should we worry about it? And what effect would changing the expert testimony rule on conclusions have on this kind of evidence?
Excuse me, I'm not aware that there's a rule that forbids a psychiatrist from saying whether or not he feels the defendant knew the difference between right and wrong, because that's what they seem to
No, do. I didn't mean to say that, but he may answer, is he insane? Which I think is, as far as the jury is concerned, what's the difference?
Well, usually I know psychiatrists will say, well, he's a schizophrenic, they're apparently schizophrenic or something like that, and describe why and what constitutes that condition. I would say, I think it would be well simply staying with traditional rules of evidence, because I don't think the charter of the commission is to go into, is to depart from standard rules of evidence. In other words, I think lay testimony is very well controlled outside. I don't see great reason to carve an exception from the law.
Well, it is an exception to the rule of evidence anyhow.
Well, yeah, but
it's
I don't
in the general rule of
evidence.
Accepted, certainly.
It's there, and I think it needs changing when the Supreme Court will do it.
The rules of evidence is an area of study that's going to be coming shortly by the Law Improvement Committee. This is something that's been discussed recently. This is one of the priority items as far as law improvement is concerned right now, is the rules of evidence.
Mr. Chairman, I
need to point
that out at the hospital. I wonder if I need to excuse
you. Yes,
I want
to ask right now.
Question.
You want to respond to that?
Which?
Does anybody have a last question that I
want to
ask?
I would like the doctor to come back when we do get into the sentencing area. That would be most helpful.
I wanted to ask the rest of you, or all of you. It's getting near the noon hour. It looks to me like if we're going to finish, it's going to take some time. Does anybody want to stay here and finish? Do you want to go to lunch and come back? Or what's your desire?
It seems to me that we're not going to conclude this area today in any event.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to finish.
I personally prefer adjournment shortly afternoon and take up again. But I
well, Dr. Levin, if you desire to come back, we'd be happy to have you. We'd probably take up around 1:30.
Well, let's put it this way: how badly do you need me?
I might add that the doctor was kind enough to come here on rather short notice this week. And
all right. Well, we probably
really have some other commitments.
We probably could get along this afternoon, but we'd sure like to have you come back when we return.
Before the doctor goes, could I ask this? How difficult would it be, doctor, to supply us with figures as to over the last several years, how many have been sent down after a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity, and the average length of stay until they are released, and then figures as to the numbers whom you find not to be able to assist in their own defense over the past several years.
And their average length of stay, too, perhaps?
Yes, and the average length of stay on that.
I really don't know how difficult it would be. I don't imagine it would be too difficult. It would be very easy if there's some record somewhere in the state as to the names of people that have been tried. Is there a record somewhere in the law files of people or trials in the state?
County. Well, you wouldn't have them indexed yourself that way.
Not that way. We could look at all our court orders. And, we run about 150 a year. It used to be less. So it takes a lot of file searching. But I could look at it for a couple of years and let you know. I'd be interested in myself.
I don't know whether the Corrections Division is running some statistical studies. And they may have those figures. I don't know.
I think they are. Yes, the Board of Control is ordered them today.
And possibly the state police figures might show those. I just don't know.
We might get some graduate student here, some PhD, helping do this research.
Well, our statistics are all kept by the Board of Control, and it's sometimes a little difficult for one of us down the line to get the priority on the computer. And that sort of makes some trees. You might have more success with them than we will.
Well, thank you, Dr. Trelawney.
Thank you very much.
George,
I'll see what I can do, Judge. Thank you.
George, do you think we should move ahead for a little while, or should we, at this point, take a break and come back in an hour and 15 minutes?
Well, I think we ought to take a break. I agree with the judge. Really, what we're doing now is identifying the problems and how we cope with them.
I think you misinterpreted the judge's attitude.
Yeah, I don't think that's what he was referring to.
We'll look at the judge today and say until 12:31 and quit for the day, wasn't it?
Well, that'd be my own personal inclination, but I don't want
to. Like a misinterpretation?
Why well, I didn't
not
want to
the
be,
first time the judge could misinterpret it.
I didn't want to even get through the material if we think there are.
We misinterpret Justice Sloan every day.
How do you all feel? Do you want to try to stick around until we get through what he's written, or do you want to?
It doesn't make any difference.
All right, well, are there any objections to staying and seeing how far we get the next hour? Okay, let's push on. Let's go ahead then.
Could we talk about Section 2, or are we that far along?
I don't know. I think we ought to go right in your commentary. Of course, we've been dealing with it completely already. But we're about ready to get to
one. We're not really through with one, are we?
I don't think so.
Anyway, we've identified the problems with which we'll have to cope. Generally, not, and a lot of these problems go beyond Section 1. They're obviously not a substantive kind of problem. They're procedural in the sense that dealing with the offender acting consent.
I had a couple of cases I wanted to call to your attention from the criminal law reporter. You're probably familiar with these, George. One is a federal case, U.S. versus Chandler, Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and in which the court says that it thinks that this ALI test is the best. But then they go on to say that although they think it's the best, it's not ideal. And there's some interesting language here I thought I might call the attention of the subcommittee. The court says the ideal solution, perhaps, would be to exclude the question of criminal responsibility from the trial, leaving to penologists the answers to the question of criminal responsibility, with leave to record the court's commitment as criminal or civil, depending upon the answer to that question, and to the questions of the kind and duration of the custodial care and treatment he receives.
Such an arrangement would afford an opportunity for the answers to come after the development of a much fuller, more reliable record upon more thorough psychiatric and psychological testing. Unfortunately, penology, psychiatry, and psychology have not advanced to the point that penologists would welcome such responsibilities or that Congress and judges would willingly entrust them to them. But, they're talking in terms of this. We were a minute ago about looking at this from a correction. This is a April of 68, U.S. versus Chandler.
What's the citation?
Was it law week? It's criminal law, I report. Three criminal law, 2097. 2097. It's May 8, 1968. Now, on the other side of the coin, also in three criminal law, page 2456, an Iowa case, State versus Harkness, decided July 18th of this year, and they really blasted, that is, blasted the ALI test. They say the adoption of the ALI standard would be a substantive new rule in Iowa, extending absolute immunity from criminal responsibility to persons who, although capable of understanding the nature and quality of facts, the ability to distinguish between right and wrong, are unable to control their own behavior as a result of mental disease or defect. Perhaps a revision of the rule of criminal responsibility would be forthcoming if the law felt it could place greater trust and confidence in psychiatry. The spectacle not only of individual psychiatrists in disagreement, but also entire divergent schools of thought is not an inspiring one. there was a dissent in that case, urging the ALI standards. But those are two fairly recent cases.
Well, this prompted the New York draftsman to eliminate that part of subsection, well, the control test from the New York statute. And the commission notes where the New York statute said, frankly, that the reason they dumped that part, the control part, is because the district attorneys of the state felt that it was too liberal. So they would be in accord with what I am about. Frankly, I have a feeling that view is based on misinformation. And from what Judge Burns has said, I think he, Dr. Hogan was said, that he would agree that there aren't that many people who would be escaping responsibility in their control test. I just don't think it's great an opening of the gates.
Well, he said that there would be 20% of the more serious offenders would escape under the control.
Well, they'd escape, but where would they escape? They'd escape into what we think would be the best place for them, that is the mental institution. Whether the mental institutions be able to cope with them, I don't know.
Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that that this control situation, that's going to be the person that is less treatable, or that and is more apt to be the repeated offender, and is the more serious person that we've got to take into consideration from the standpoint of the public.
I can think of one specific case that would seem to indicate that that's not entirely correct, Frank. The melancholia that comes with the menopause is a known mental illness, and it results, Goldstein points out, most often in suicide of the woman. But sometimes, this is true of men too, who, of course, find the menopause, but that particular age that some men go through, it makes them, gives them a mental disease. And as a result of that disease, they may ponder and become more morose, which results over a long period of time in killing their whole family, because they think that death is better than the living problems that they've got to face. Well, now, this is the kind of disease that passes with age. It's not the sort of thing that isn't treatable. Now, I don't know, there may be others, and I may be misleading the commission on all the medical aspects of this particular disease, because I know nothing of it except what I have read. That seems to be at least one case would say that the control problems are treatable. I don't see why they wouldn't be as a matter of medical practice.
Yeah, but it seems to me that that you also open the door on control to the person who just simply gets, like most of your crimes of violence, where they just get angry and lose their control. I mean, they may know the difference between right and wrong and this type of thing, but they don't have control. I think this is what he's talking about, these 20% of these people. They're the persons that that can kill or seriously injure or commit very serious crimes simply because of their because they are angry and don't have control. And what are you going to do to treat that person? I mean, well, you're not mad, you're perfectly okay. So what's he going to do in the state hospital then? He's going to teach him how not to get mad.
Well, I don't know what the answer is, frankly, because I'm not medically trained at all. But I assume that there are courses of treatment for that kind of person. I wish the doctor was still here.
Or you have situations where an individual may not, and this is quite common, I'm sure.
He gets angry for a reason.
He may not be an alcoholic, but the minute he gets a few drinks in him, he becomes violent and he starts assaulting people, particularly those around him, his family. This is fairly common. It seems to me you have a question there to deal with. A question of control, because...
Yeah, that he may have been able to know that what he's doing was wrong, but because of his
envision.
Well, I don't think that would qualify
without
him over.
You envision keeping the voluntary intoxication statute as long as this complete substitute?
Yeah, I envision keeping that. That's an assumption that I make, and maybe completely incorrect, Commissioner. One, but I envision keeping that particular statute.
Okay.
Now we are putting on top of that, if we go for 402 subparagraph 1, which we discussed, partial responsibility, we are putting into Oregon definitely another aspect, a similar related aspect.
That merely codifies what it is.
I suppose it's not.
You know, the specific point, I guess, is still which definition to adopt. And, well, before I became a prosecutor, I was all for ALI. I very much changed over the years. I'm not at all persuaded that a case has been made to change McNaughton. Possible exception of some form of, you know, control. I'm not persuaded, one, that McNaughton doesn't work at least as well as any other rule in terms of who's been going to the hospital and who's been going to the pen and who's been getting on probation and who's been acquitted. I just see no case. There is an occasional case which tugs away at people, like the Van Cleek case, where the woman was sick, and I would only repeat, you know, what I said earlier. We're not trying to define mental illness, we're trying to define responsibility. And a case like that, where it seems to be wrong on the equities, can be handled in another way, and that is by changing the administrative powers of the corrections people, for example, you know, to shift her to the hospital for treatment of her condition.
Which they could do now anyway.
Or to have the judge directly put her in the hospital.
Yes, now that, yeah. Or possibly that. But that's exercised very sparingly, I understand.
Yeah.
And it should be expanded.
Yeah.
I mean, it really should be. And maybe some policy behind the statute should be expressed.
Well, I also see that
under McNaughton, which generally has pretty good results, the psychiatrist with the judge's tolerance and the lawyer's encouragement do push very far on their testimony and do, in practice, redefine the terms of McNaughton to allow broad testimony and conclusions desirable to the defense. You know, it sounds archaic, and to say that it was passed in or formed in 1852, was it? You know, it makes it sound like a terrible rule. And it isn't related to psychiatric concepts, but then we're not trying to. We're trying to draw legal concepts. There's a rule to change, that there's a reason to change.
I'm somewhat like Jake in that, although perhaps for different reasons, when I was a district attorney, although I didn't have near the experience that fellows like Jake had, because I was in a small county where he didn't have much business, but frankly, at that time, as a matter of just intellectual belief, I thought McNaughton was wrong. So happened, I only had one case involving insanity plea when I was prosecuting in Harney County. And that was a case in which a 16-year-old boy beat his father to death with a softball bat. And just as a matter of side interest, his father was trying to defend himself with a bottle of ketchup. Excuse me. But in any event, this lad pleaded insanity, and the jury acquitted him. And six women on the jury, and every darn one of them had a teenage son. So, in any event, he was acquitted by reason of insanity, and the judge, I think very properly, immediately turned him loose. He called in a doctor, and didn't have any psychiatrist in Burns, of course. He called in a doctor and said, "Is this man sane?" He said, "Sure." He said, "Okay, on your way, buddy." And that was it. But as I say, at that period of time, I was convinced that McNaughton rule was poor and so on. I believe, along the same lines that Jake does. I think it's as good as any of the others. It doesn't, as a practical matter, at least based on the experience I've had since, and particularly in the last 2 years on the bench, the existence of the McNaughton rule doesn't really prevent most of the helpful psychiatric testimony that you get in under any rule. And frankly, I don't think it's important enough to change it. I think assuming we deal with the other end of the problem, namely, what do we do with them when they're either convicted and they have mental troubles or acquitted by reason of insanity? What do we do with them then is really the key part of the problem, whichever rule we adopt. And frankly, I can't see that whatever rule we adopt is that important. Furthermore, as a pragmatic matter, I think that by and large, the legislature and the public generally, at this point in time, is going to be less willing to accept a change to what is felt to be a easier rule than if we just stick with McDonald's.
Where are we going to get over to the psychiatrist?
Incidentally, George Van Hoosen is sponsored the bill that Governor Vito has since changed physically.
Well, isn't it really, the Goldstein here says too that really the only thing wrong with McNaughton, and the only reason why McNaughton should be changed is simply because there's been so much objection to it, feeling that it is a straight-laced deal, and really it isn't. And that if you could get people to understand this, that the McNaughton rule is as fine a test as any.
How are we going to get it over to the mental health people, or into the psychiatrists, or is this a problem we need to deal with?
I make just one observation here, again based on the literature, and not on practical experience, but I agree with Jake and Judge Burns and Frank that McNaughton is a perfectly good rule. And if we didn't change our rule, I think that Oregon would be fine. And I have no objection to it. I'm not opposed to McNaughton at all. I make the observation, however, that Professor Goldstein makes, and I think is legitimate, that we ought to have a controlled formulation in McNaughton. That it is possibly, if there's any criticism that can be made of it at all, legitimate criticism, not the stereotype that everybody has that McNaughton is straight-laced when in fact it is not, but the criticism is that we ought to be a little more liberal on the kind of evidence on control and the kind of instructions. And he says, and I tend to agree, that if a jury is instructed not only on right-wrong, but is instructed on the control, if the person didn't have the control of his actions, that the jury isn't going to be conned into letting psychopaths go. Because the very fact that the jury is told that this fellow couldn't control his actions, although he knew right from wrong, sets up in the juror's mind a very practical block to that defense. And the jury just isn't going to swallow it as a practical matter unless they are absolutely and thoroughly convinced of the medical nature of that control. That it just looking at that fellow across the room who says, oh, I knew right from wrong, but I just couldn't control myself, the jury is going to say to itself, bunk. So I don't think it's going to be this great liberalization even that the psychiatrist would probably want from it, those who are in the very liberal dynamic school. But I would think, my own personal preference is McNaughton, as the model penal code really is McNaughton, plus the control test.
Well, George, maybe one of the things that concerns me is not whether the jury is going to ultimately buy it, but the fact that you're going to have to defend against it every dang time.
Yes, but shouldn't we think of the other side, though, Frank, the defense side?
Oh, of course not.
I mean, every day Kate has any questions.
By the way, I'm very interested in sideline.
It bothers me. I don't like it. Thank you.
The 1962 California Commission to Study Criminal Justice and especially the bifurcated trial took a very critical view of the split trial. And it said of the 1925 commission that recommended that trial that it was prosecution-oriented. Now, citing the membership and the general philosophies involved there. Now, that's kind of a dirty word for us to talk about, is prosecution-oriented. But I think you ought to be aware of that fact, that this is kind of the reaction some people have to a split trial. That's prosecution-oriented, or the reasons for it. I don't know. Legitimate or not, but
it's
kind of interesting for you to know.
Bruce Baldy is tied up in a case which is anticipated to last 2 or 3 months in federal court, so he won't have the defense side for at least that period of time.
The point I make in general is that I'm sure we all realize this, that we've got to think not of our own interest as a judge or as a district attorney or as a defense lawyer, but as the overall community interest in this kind of a formulation.
Well, that's all I'm after, George, is just fairness.
Especially for our side.
Yeah. Fairness, yeah. Secretary of the Gang, there's a minister.
He's going on a date. Okay, shall we move on to anything you want to cut about the commentary?
I don't think so. That's not too much.
Why don't we move on to section 2?
Section 2 is one that's going to go some time in anyway. Section from the district attorney.
Right. I sure don't want to lose sight of the organizational order of the model penal code inserts before my section 2, the partial responsibility section. And I want to leave that certainly open. I don't intend to have it beside that. But we ought to answer the question, yes or no, should we insert that in this responsibility section?
Any comments?
That's where it belongs.
Well, isn't it, as we pointed out, somebody pointed out earlier, isn't that essentially what the law now is?
Well, we're not sure.
Has never really been articulated.
Look pretty close in practices on that, and the court has stayed open. In fact, very recently, a very recent advance sheet case, our court has said in split trials that had the defendant raised, he would plead guilty by reason of insanity, and he challenged an instruction which I believe was on not giving the control test, at least another issue. The court said, had he raised the issue, was he guilty of the act at all? It wouldn't know exactly how to respond because the verdict, as we all know, is not guilty by reason of insanity. It doesn't say anything about his guilt with respect to the act at all. So he hasn't had an adjudication, in a sense, on that point. And our court has said, dictum interstitially, that we may have to reach, or we would consider then, a system of split trials to handle that issue. So it definitely has an open mind on the subject, and I don't think the law is settled in Oregon to the point where they have to cope with it.
Okay, let's go to section 2.
I suppose the reason Section 2 is here really is, again, a problem identifier. This subject, I have provided for this change of substantial change as far as the law of Oregon goes, but not substantial in that about half the states already follow the rule where the prosecution must bear the burden of proving sanity beyond a reasonable doubt where there is some evidence introduced by the defendant. This is certainly not a new idea, and it's about half the states follow it. I am certain here.